Now, my sense of fairness is probably going to get me into controversy again. But I've been there before. I don't really care if the Pope rides in a popmobile. And the paper today indicated that maybe there's only two people in the world that live in a robe their whole lifetime, Hugh Hefner and the Pope. Once in a while, the Los Angeles Herald Examiner comes up with a gem or two. Federal agencies are going to spend about $7 million to protect the Pope while he's here, and local costs will match it just in the Los Angeles area. And he comes with bodyguards from abroad, who we're told are not armed, foreign, I mean. Bodyguards from abroad. I got it, folks. I can see what kind of night we're going to have now. Why are you so nice when I'm gone and turn so bad when I get back? Turn the lights down till I can't see them. Including those from abroad. That do not carry weapons. We're supposed to believe that. But are trained in a secret kind of martial arts. I find that very interesting. Not a single person in the press is saying a word about the Pope and his bulletproof Pope Mobile. The millions that are being spent in order that the faithful might look at him. And the local coordinator of the police said that we're having to treat this and view it in the way that people worship an idol. His residence, everywhere he stays, will be declared a foreign embassy during the tenure of his stay there, which ought to raise vibrations of church, state, violations all over this land. And the reason it's declared a temporary embassy wherever he stays is so that federal authorities will have jurisdiction. There isn't a violation of the separation of church and state, and a violation of the Establishment Clause. I've never seen one. The federal government, in order to have the authority to spend federal tax dollars to defend the Pope, declares every place that he stays a temporary federal embassy, or a temporary foreign embassy. There will be more things sold with his picture on it than Oral Roberts has been able to produce with his picture on it. There will be more tax dollars spent to pay federal officers to hear the Pope perform a mass in person. I really don't object to that at all. What I object to from my sense of fairness is the way the news media seizes upon any such adulation for any other religious leader, even in minute, microscopic size by comparison, and chews on it like a dog on a bone while they join the parade of adulation for this religious leader. Since when are the separation of church and state matters and the First Amendment against establishment of religion? Since when does size determine whether or not they apply? And don't give me history. All that history has done for the Catholic Church is give it more time to do more evil things. It's done plenty of good things, too. But it's got just as many skeletons in its closet as Jim Baker ever could conceive. I really don't care. They use Air Force One to fly him around. I don't care if they send Reagan on a horseback ride and take his personal secret service people to guard the Pope. What I'm objecting to is the lack of fairness in the media. The way in which they go along with this wholesale and applauding. While any other religious leader in America that happens to have the goodwill of his followers or happens to have the need of bodyguards or happens to have the need of certain perks that go along with a public figure, the way they attack him or her. My sense of fairness is violated. What's good for the goose is good for the gander. Just because we disagree with the Bhagwan we have no more right to make fun of people that want to sit and look at a guy riding a Rolls Royce who hasn't said anything for 2 or 3 years. We have no right to beat his followers to death as being cultic, low brains, while we go along with the adulation that's going to be heaped upon the Pope by his followers, which will include some of the poorest people in the world. Who will sacrifice and deprive themselves to get a little glimpse of the Pope passing in a bulletproof mobile. Say, well, but Bhagwan and his organization committed some crimes. Which leads me to the Vatican connection. The astonishing account of a $1 billion counterfeit stock deal between the mafia and the church. Everything the Catholic Church does is big. Reminds me of the guy's first trip to Texas. Went to a party in a big old bar, oversized stools, and they give him a drink and a big old mug about the size of a bucket. One swap knocked him out. He said, how come these stools are so big and the drinks are so big? And some big old Texan slapped him on the back and says, everything's big in Texas. Walked pretty good. He said, where's the restroom? They pointed down the hall. He went down the hall, took the wrong turn, fell in the swimming pool. Last they heard, he is yelling to the top of his lungs, good God, don't flush it. Everything's big in the Catholic Church, too. I started this once before. I think that it was time. To get back to it. There are two sides to this story. One is the side told by the New York cop that stumbled onto it and broke it. The other is the side written by David A. Yallop in God's Name, an investigation into the murder of Pope John Paul I. I don't like the Bhagwan. I mean, I was looking for Doc's pad way back after you had decided to set me free from a hotel. And I went to look to a place over here in Hollywood, owned by the Bhagwan. Just the way he painted the rooms of that house. Made me hate him. 3 days in it, and I'd have had a nervous breakdown. I don't like the Bhagwan. I don't like a lot of the popes either. And we have studied church history, and we have not traced the development at Rome. We just encountered in the church councils the assertion of the primacy of Rome. It became prima for sure. Remember this? The spiritual leader of nearly one-fifth of the world's population wields immense power. Yet any uninformed observer of Albino Luciani at the beginning of his reign as Pope John Paul I would have found it difficult to believe that this man truly embodied such power. This is the background to the coming to power of the current pope. The diffidence and humility emanating from this small, quiet, 65-year-old Italian had led many to conclude that his papacy would not be particularly noteworthy. The well-informed, however, knew differently. Albino Luciani had embarked on a revolution. On September 28, 1978, he'd been pope for 33 days. In little more than a month, he had initiated various courses of action that, had they been completed, would have had a direct and dynamic effect on us all. The majority in this world would have applauded his decisions. A minority would have been appalled. The man who had quickly been labeled the Smiling Pope intended to remove the smiles from a number of faces on the following day. That evening, Luciani sat down to dinner in the third-floor dining room of the Apostolic Palace within Vatican City. Not a Motel 6, by the way. I have yet to see in a magazine article taken pictures of the mansions inhabited by television evangelists. I have yet to see them include the Pope. He's become a worldwide television evangelist. And he got a mansion that will outdo any of them. Why is it okay for him? either make all preachers, including the Pope, live in a tent, or stop the singling out of certain ones. It is the contributions and sacrifices of the faithful, including the poor, giving Peter's pence, that built that thing, including the Felix symbol that is moved in the middle of St. Peter's Square, Cleopatra's Needle. Anyway, Luciani sat down to dinner in the third floor dining room of the Apostolic Palace within Vatican City. With him were his two secretaries, Father Diego Lorenzi, who had worked closely with him in Venice for more than 2 years when, as a cardinal, Luciani had been patriarch there, and Father John McGee, newly acquired since the papal election. As the nuns who worked in the papal apartments hovered anxiously I guess all you got to do to get away with a woman living in your apartment with you for preacher, just put a black robe on them. Am I accusing? No. No, I think there's sure as ribbon of snow. I'm just saying, if the news media had the guts, they could make something out of it. The point is, I'm not accusing. I don't care. I think that what I'm going to talk about is common to all large organizations, church or non-church. News media, broadcasting organizations. I think a lot of investigative reporters get their stories by sleeping with somebody. The whole point, and don't anybody miss it, is why are... And I'm not one of the specimen. But why are these American preachers, television evangelists or otherwise, who attain a position of some leadership and the perks that go along with it in order that they might relate on a peer-level relationship with leaders in other dimensions, why must they be under constant attack from the dadgum news media who enjoy the same dadgum perks that they are envious of that preachers as leaders in their domain happen to have? And don't give me this crap about tax-deductible dollars. Catholics get it too, you know. I read an article in the paper the other day about a radio station in Alaska run by a priest. The Catholic organization, it is very clear that neither directly nor indirectly can any broadcasting station in America be under the domain, dominion, or control, indirect as well as direct, of any foreign country or foreign entity. There are stations on television. We had one here in Los Angeles. There are television stations and radio stations all over America owned by Catholic organizations, and anybody in their right mind knows that any Catholic not yet excommunicated is under the absolute authority of the Pope. I will get around the next few weeks while we do a little parenthesis because of the happenings in Los Angeles to how the Pope became infallible. August Bernhard Hassler. a coup of the Jesuits, who have subsequently done a reversal and have ceased to be the Pope's men. A coup of the Jesuits. And one of the most ruthless political hatchet jobs ever done in any organization, worldly or spiritual. Again, the Gestalt idea is, I don't care. I don't care who Jim Baker dings. I don't care whose outfit Jerry Falwell steals. I care about his giving away of constitutional rights. But Jerry Falwell and Jim Baker deserve each other. I don't care about Oral Roberts' 900-foot Jesus. I don't care about Jimmy Swaggart's newfound poverty and his $3 million mansion that'll take him all his life to pay for. I don't care about the Pope's Pope Mobile and its deal with the mafia and its millions. I care about the insult to American intelligence of the brainwashing attempt of the news media to discredit every single religious leader in the world except one. And my sense of fairness is violated. And the history of the Catholic Church does not give the Pope the right to stand for imminent and above reproach and above criticism from the news media that guts every other religious leader in the world. I'm prepared to fight for the right of the Catholics to pour out adulation on their Pope and worship God the way they want to. I don't want to stop that. I just want an equal right on the part of Protestants, and for that matter, on the part of some of the stranger brands of religion that have come to this country, to exercise freedom of religion without the news media peddling its own brand of religion, namely its God, and it gives approval to the Pope, no one else. That evening, Ruciani sat down to dinner in the third floor dining room of the Apostolic Palace within Vatican City. With him were his two secretaries, Father Diego Lorenzi, who had worked closely with him in Venice for more than 2 years when, as a Cardinal, Luciani had been patriarch there, and Father John McGee, newly acquired since the papal election, as the nuns who worked in the papal apartments hovered anxiously. How come the Woman's Lib movement hasn't opposed the very concept of nuns? Taking the frame of reference of Women's Lib, nunneries are the most demeaning institution yet alive in the world. And this current Pope has only one competitor in this world when it comes to chauvinism. Me. If women had any sense, they would pray daily for the instant removal from this life of both the Pope and Gene Scott. The difference between me and the Pope is I know women are superior. Just be damned if I'm going to become one of their slaves prematurely. As long as I can hold out, I'm going to. Because I know women are superior creatures. And nothing Ain't nothing a woman can't beat a man at. Therefore, even in a foot race, I would insist on a 100-yard head start. Ain't nothing fair in my... I don't have a fair bone in me when it comes to dealing with women. The Pope, he's a fool. He thinks women should be in subjection and are inferior people. He's worse than me. Mine is just a pragmatic, sinful, self-serving desire to remain preeminent in the insecurity of sure knowledge that I'm inferior but ain't going to give an inch unless it's taken away from me. The Pope, he's still living in the mental Middle Ages on that subject. But you'll find these stupid, empty-faced female newscasters prostrating themselves around him all the time. Maybe there is something to that statement about Hefner and the Pope. Maybe there is something about robes that create an aura, helps to keep the woman under. You want me to continue it all tonight? I'm just getting into this. Doc, yesterday on Channel 4, I saw a special on the Pope in Rome with two local Channel 4 reporters, and there was some footage at the end with these two reporters meeting the Pope. One bowed and kissed his ring, and the other one kneeled on the ground in front of him. I was shocked. At least we can see their true attitude. Can you imagine them doing this to any Protestant preacher? I think I'm going to make a condition of any newsman getting an interview with me that they bow and kiss my ring. I might one up the Pope and have him kiss something else. On September 28, 1978, Albino Luciani, the so-called smiling pope, had been pope for 33 days. In God's name is what I'm reading. An investigation into the murder of Pope John Paul I by David A. Yacht. This is the prelude to our present pope. Why isn't Nightline doing a segment on this? That evening, Luciani sat down to dinner in the third-floor dining room of the Apostolic Palace within Vatican City. The art there would pay the national debt that we have. Poor, poor, poor Pappy. With him were his two secretaries, Father Diego Lorenzi and Father John McGee. That'd be interesting to be able to call your secretary's father. And they call you Papa. As the nuns who worked in the papal apartments hovered anxiously, Albino Luciani ate a frugal meal of clear soup, veal, fresh beans, and a little salad. He sipped occasionally from a glass of water and considered the events of the day and the decisions he had made. While sisters Vicenza, Assunta, Corinda, and Gabriella quietly served the three men, four to serve three, as they watched on television the events that preoccupied Italy that evening, other men in other places were being caused deep anxiety by the activities of Albino Luciani. One floor below the papal apartments, the lights were still on in the Vatican Bank. I don't care that they have a bank. I've told you I don't feel we'll achieve our destiny as a church until we have one. But we would be criticized. And we haven't even done anything yet, just the thought of having one. That's what I dislike. I don't think the news media has any right to even talk about the Constitution until they learn to practice its precepts that begins with fair and equal treatment. Its head, that is the Vatican Bank's head, Bishop Paul Marcinkus, had other more pressing problems on his mind than his evening meal. He's hiding out in the Vatican now because Italy has an arrest warrant out on him. If Italy didn't have an arrest warrant out on him, he'd be serving on the bodyguard team of the Pope when they come here to Los Angeles. That was his role previously. Chicago-born Marcinkus had learned about survival on the streets of Cicero, Illinois. During his meteoric rise to power, he had survived many moments of crisis. Now he was confronted with the most serious challenge he'd ever faced. In the past 33 days, his colleagues in the bank had noticed a remarkable change in the man who controlled the Vatican's millions. And by the way, they haven't disclosed. I mean, it seems the news media will only accept a preacher who has filed disclosure records with that little two-bit monitor of religious organizations in Chicago, and they make much of the fact that some of the biggest TV preachers don't belong to the group. I don't think the Pope has joined. I doubt you can find a disclosure of papal expenses even for this trip. I don't know what he wears under those robes. In the past 33 days, his colleagues in the bank had noticed a remarkable change in the man who controlled the Vatican's millions. The 6'3", 224-pound extrovert had become moody and introspective. He was visibly losing weight, and his face had acquired a gray pallor. Vatican City, in many respects, is a village, and secrets are hard to keep in a village. Word had reached Marcinkus that the new pope had quietly begun a personal investigation of the Vatican Bank, and specifically of the methods Marcinkus was using to run that bank. Now, once they get this pope out of the way, which is what this book's about, this current pope, adored by millions, hasn't done much to him. He's let him hide out in the Vatican premises to avoid the arrest warrant by the Italian government. wonder why nobody on the 6 o'clock news will ask the Pope what he's going to do about Marcinkus and the arrest warrant outstanding on Marcinkus. Word had reached Marcinkus that the new Pope had quietly begun a personal investigation of the Vatican Bank and specifically of the methods Marcinkus was using to run that bank. Countless times since the arrival of the new Pope, Marcinkus had regretted that business in 1972 concerning the Banca Cattolica del Venetio. The Vatican Secretary of State, Cardinal Jean Villot, was another who was still at his desk on that September evening. He studied the list of appointments, resignations to be asked for, and transfers the popes had handed him 1 hour previously. He had advised, argued, and remonstrated, but to no avail. Luciani had been adamant. It was by any standards a dramatic reshuffle. It would set the church in new directions. Directions that Villot and the others on the list who were about to be replaced considered highly dangerous. When these changes were announced, there would be millions of words written and uttered by the world's media, analyzing, dissecting, prophesying, explaining. The real explanation, however, would not be discussed and would not be given a public airing. There was one common denominator, one fact that linked each of the men about to be replaced. Villot was aware of it. More important, so was the Pope. It had been one of the factors that had caused him to act, to strip these men of real power and put them into relatively harmless positions. It was Freemasonry. The evidence the Pope had acquired indicated that within the Vatican City State there were over 100 Masons, ranging from cardinals to priests. This, despite the fact that canon law stated that to be a Freemason ensured automatic excommunication. Luciani was further preoccupied with an illegal Masonic lodge that had penetrated far beyond Italy in its search for wealth and power. It called itself P2. The fact that it had penetrated the Vatican walls and formed links with priests, bishops, and even cardinals made P2 anathema to Albino Luciani. Villot had already become deeply concerned about the new papacy before this latest bombshell. He was one of the very few who was aware of the dialogue taking place between the Pope and the State Department in Washington. He knew that on October 23rd, the Vatican would be receiving a congressional delegation, and that on October 24th, the delegation would be having a private audience with the Pope. The Lord looked carefully at the Vatican dossier on Albino Luciani. He had also read the secret memorandum that Luciani, then Bishop of Vittorio Veneto, had sent to Paul VI before the papal announcement of the encyclical on human life, an encyclical that prohibited Catholics from using any artificial form of birth control. He knew that the Pope was planning a major change in the Church's position. 3. In Buenos Aires, another banker, Roberto Calvi, had Pope John Paul I on his mind as September 1978 drew to a close. In the preceding weeks, he had discussed the problems posed by the new Pope with his protectors, Licio Gelli and Umberto Ortolani. Two men who could list among their many assets their complete control of Calvi, chairman of Banco Ambrosiano. Calvi had been beset with problems even before the election that placed Albino Luciani upon St. Peter's throne. The Bank of Italy had been secretly investigating Calvi's Milan Bank since April. It was an investigation prompted by a mysterious poster campaign against Calvi that had erupted in late 1977. The posters had given details of some of Calvi's criminal activities and hinted at a worldwide range of criminal acts. Calvi was aware of exactly what progress the Bank of Italy was making with its investigation. His close friendship with Licio Gelli ensured a day-by-day account of it. He was equally aware of the papal investigation into the Vatican Bank. Like Marcinkus, he knew it was only a matter of time before the two independent investigations realized that to probe one of these financial empires was to probe both. He was doing everything within his considerable power to thwart the Bank of Italy and protect his financial empire, from which he was in the process of stealing over $1 billion. Careful analysis of Roberto Calvi's position in September 1978 makes it abundantly clear that if Pope Paul had been succeeded by an honest man, and Luciani was, then Calvi faced total ruin, the collapse of his bank, and certain imprisonment. There is no doubt whatever that the new Pope Albino Luciano was just such a man, now only 33 days in office. In New York, Sicilian banker Michele Sindona had also been anxiously monitoring Pope John Paul's activities. For over 3 years, Sindona had been fighting the Italian government's attempts to have him extradited. The Italian government wanted him brought to Milan to face charges involving fraudulent diversion of $225 million. I'm telling you, whatever the Catholic Church gets involved in, it's big. Earlier that year in May, it appeared that Sindona had finally lost the long battle. A federal judge had ruled that the extradition request should be granted. Sindona remained free on $3 million bail while his lawyers prepared to play one last card. They demanded that the United States government prove that there was a well-founded evidence to justify extradition. Sindona asserted that the charges brought against him by the Italian government were the work of communists and other left-wing politicians. His lawyers also asserted that the Milan prosecutor had concealed evidence that would clear Sindona, and that if their client were returned to Italy, he would be almost certainly assassinated. The hearing was scheduled for November. That summer in New York, others were equally active on behalf of Michele Sindona. One mafia member, Luigi Roncisvalli, a professional killer, was threatening the life of witness Nicola Biasi, who had earlier given evidence against Sindona in the extradition proceedings. The mafia also had a contract out on the life of Assistant U.S. Attorney John Kenney, who was chief prosecutor in the extradition proceedings. The fee being offered for the murder of the government attorney was $100,000. If Pope John Paul I continued to dig into the affairs of the Vatican Bank, then no amount of mafia contracts would help Sindona in his fight against being returned to Italy. The web of corruption at the Vatican Bank, which included the laundering of mafia money through that bank, went back beyond Calvi to Michele Sindona in Chicago. Another prince of the Catholic Church worried and fretted about events in the Vatican. Cardinal John Cody, head of one of the richest archdioceses in the world. Cody ruled over 2.5 million Catholics and nearly 3,000 priests over 450 parishes with an annual income that he refused to reveal in its entirety to anyone. Catholic Church is a lot smarter than these beanhead TV evangelists. It was, in fact, in excess of $250 million. Fiscal secrecy was only one of the problems that whirled around Cody. By 1978, he had ruled Chicago for 13 years, and the demands for his replacement had reached extraordinary proportions. Priests, nuns, lay workers, and people from many secular professions had petitioned Rome in the thousands for the removal of the man they regarded as a despot. Pope Paul had agonized for years about removing Cody, the predecessor of the current 33-day reigning pope. His predecessor, Pope Paul, had agonized for years about removing Cody. The pope had, on at least one occasion, actually steeled himself and made the decision, only to revoke the order at the last moment. The complex, tortured personality of Paul, predecessor of Luciani, was only part of the reason for the vacillation. Paul knew that other secret allegations had been made against Cody with a substantial amount of evidence that indicated the urgent need to replace the Cardinal of Chicago. During late September, Cody received a phone call from Rome. The Vatican City Village had leaked another piece of information, information well paid for over the years by Cardinal Cody. The caller told the Cardinal that where Pope Paul had agonized, his successor, Calvino Luciano, John Paul I, had acted. This pope had decided that Cardinal Cody was to be replaced. Over at least three of these men lurked the shadow of another, Licio Gelli. Let me continue. Come, the news ain't going to talk about any of this, still unresolved, while they join the parade of idol worshipers and then belittle any Protestant who seeks to show love and affection and respect for their leaders. What's fair is fair, friends. I am attacking the general unfairness of the media that is creating a state of mind in this country that approves an adulation for the Pope, that approves expenditures of tax dollars to protect the Pope, approves the government declaring every temporary residence that he lives in while he's here an embassy in order that tax-supported federal authorities might have jurisdiction over him. I am disapproving the news media that bow and kiss his hand and kiss his ring, and euphorate in their story just because the Pope happens to have a larger following than some Protestant leaders, while they attack unmercifully the right of Protestants to give to the people that they choose to follow in religious leadership, and the tendency to suggest that every world leader in a religious frame must live in abject poverty except the Pope. I'm tired of them acting like Mother Teresa is the model for the Catholic Church. The Pope's the head of it. He wears enough jewelry to feed her four kids for a year. I'm tired of their asininity and the insult to the intelligence of the general public with their fawning after the Pope and their merciless attack on every other religious leader. And I'll get to it probably Sunday as I preach on the harlot woman of the book of Revelation. I'll fight for the right of Catholics to bankrupt themselves in their religious kicks. If they get joy out of spending their poverty on the Pope, if they get joy out of persecuting their bodies and risking getting trampled in the Colosseum, in order to hold their kid up for a chance to get a glimpse of the Pope, I'll fight for their right to do that. That's not the issue. The issue is the unmitigated prejudice of the news media that's on the attack against every Protestant church leader. Oh, but some of them are crooks. Which leads me to, in God's name, an investigation into the murder of Pope John Paul I, David A. Yollop, the night of September 28, 1978, about this time of year, is when Albino Luciani Pope John Paul I had taken office. And he had instigated four reaching changes that were to take effect the following day. Interesting coincidence. Including an investigation into the Vatican Bank, headed by Chicago-born Masinkas, who's been hiding out in the Vatican while the Pope runs around in his Pope-mobile, receiving the plaudits of the news media, with never once a Nightline program dedicating to the activities of the Vatican Bank. Burbank Call said, a few weeks ago on NPR, I heard that the Italian Supreme Court had ruled that the Vatican did not have to release Masinkas to the Italian authorities. As far as I know, the rest of the media, with the exception of the BBC, has been totally silent on the subject. While this People's Pope never once is having to face a prying question from an investigative reporter, why don't you, if you have nothing to hide, turn Masinkas over? Why are you hiding Masinkas? Over at least three of these men that in previous half-hour segments I read about lurked the shadow of another, Licio Gelli. Men called him Il Burattinaio. I'm not sure of my Italian. The puppet master. The puppets were many and were placed in numerous countries. He controlled P2, the mysterious, powerful Freemason group in violation of church canon law that had penetrated the Vatican. And through P2, he controlled Italy. In Buenos Aires, the city where he discussed the problem of the new pope with Calvi, the puppet master had organized the triumphant return to power of Juan Perón, a fact that Perón subsequently acknowledged by kneeling at Gelli's feet. If Masinkas, Sindona, or Calvi, personalities we gave some thumbnail sketches of in the previous hour, were threatened with the various courses of action planned by the new Pope Albino Luciani, it was in Licio Gelli's direct interest that the threat be removed. It was abundantly clear that on September 28, 1978, these six men, Masinkas, Velo, Calvi, Cody, Sindona, and Gelli, had a great deal to fear if the papacy of John Paul I continued. It is equally clear that all of them stood to gain in a variety of ways if Pope John Paul I should suddenly die. He did. Sometime during the late evening of September 28, 1978, and the early morning of September 29, 1978, 33 days after his election, Albino Luciani died. Time of death, unknown. Cause of death, unknown. Contrary to Italian law, no autopsy. Time of death unknown, cause of death unknown. Now, the other side of this story is recounted in the book, The Vatican Connection. The astonishing account of a $1 billion counterfeit stock deal between the mafia and the church. Look at that picture close up. The Bible and dollars. If this had been a TV evangelist in America, we'd still be having it crammed down our throats by the news media. Many strands to this astonishing story. I mean, this is something the news media should be able to eat up. Playboy bunnies being turned onto drugs and into hookers by a couple of lower echelon mafiosi in New York. A contract for a beating and, if necessary, a killing given by mafia chieftain Vincent Russo on California real estate dealer Jerry Mark Jacobs. 3-2 German financiers and housing developers meeting in a Munich hotel room with Vincent Russo. John Connolly, then the U.S. Secretary of Treasury, now bankrupt, conversing in a Munich hotel lobby with Jacob's father, Ricky. 5, Archbishop Paul Marcinkus, the Vatican Minister of Finance, masterminding the plot to purchase $1 billion in phony securities. 6, the subsequent collapse of several Italian banks and the arrest of Michele Sindona, the financier deeply involved with those banks and a close associate of Archbishop Marcinkus. 7, U.S. Attorney General Richard Kleindienst intervening to protect those at the top when the investigation got too close. 8. Matteo De Lorenzo was in a mellow and nostalgic mood. I warn you. It was late on a warm spring night, and he had spent the evening on the town. His aide and traveling companion, Vincent Russo, had shown him the sights of Munich, and together they had toured the best of the Bavarian capital's night spots. Had perhaps eaten a little too much heavy German food and washed it down with a little too much good liquor. By midnight, back in their suite at the Bayerischerhof Hotel, they were flushed with the glow of satiety and with the anticipation of great financial success. They paused for a nightcap and then went to bed. Despite the fatigue, sleep did not come easily. All that good food and liquor combined with jet lag sat heavily on the stomach and frayed the nerves. And at least for Marty De Lorenzo, there was a trace of homesickness. He was 4 from his modest house in Bayside, Queens, and at 61, like many men his age, he found it hard to adapt to radical change and had grown accustomed to a regular routine. His normal orbit did not usually include an expensive suite in a deluxe European hotel. A short, somewhat overweight man, looking older than his years, with a round, open, and often smiling face, he would have seen more at home behind the counter in a small neighborhood grocery, surrounded by a dozen grandchildren for whom he would always have an inexhaustible supply of pennies and candy, and by a group of old cronies with whom he'd be trading an inexhaustible repertoire of tall stories during idle hours. To pass those hours that night, in a strange bed, in an unfamiliar city until sleep came, he mused softly into the darkness, talked reflectively across the night table that separated his bed from Risso's. He talked about the past, about how things had been in the old days when he'd been young and ambitious. It was a monologue, broken now and then by some drowsy comment from Risso to indicate that he was still awake and listening. Quote, "It's always been a tough world to make money," DiLorenzo summed up in those final moments before drifting into sleep. "Things has to get better. And you see, we're using our heads. We started using our brains. Of course, a lot of people never had the brains to use, but some of us, there was bootlegging, right? Then from bootlegging, we went into numbers. Numbers to horses. But you had to have a brain to go with it. It goes from one thing to the other, then into shylocking, then legitimate business. That means it took us a long time to realize that legitimate business is the best thing. When I got into legitimate business, it was stocks." Marty DiLorenzo was indeed into stocks and bonds and a lot of other things, too. Vincent Risso was overseer of many of those DiLorenzo interests. He was the man who had put the portfolio together and was charged with its safekeeping, with making it produce ever-increasing profits. It was a portfolio that might have been the envy of any investor, of even the sharpest Wall Street trader. It was worth close to $1 billion, and it was filled with such choice blue-chip investments as United States Treasury bills, bonds and notes, bonds of the Federal Intermediate Credit Bank and the Federal National Mortgage Association, common stock and bonds in major corporations such as National Aviation Company, Unishops Incorporated, General Portland Cement Company, International Business Machines, Beneficial Finance Company, California Computer Corporation, First Union Incorporated, Capital Holding Corporation, Coca-Cola Bottling Company of Los Angeles, Occidental Petroleum Corporation, Norton Simon Incorporated, Chrysler Corporation, Pan American World Airways Incorporated, American Telephone and Telegraph Company, General Electric Corporation, and more. There was just one trouble. DiLorenzo and Risso were neither ordinary investors nor sharp speculators. They didn't watch the ticker tape, calculating whether to buy or sell or hold on to the movements of fractions of a point. They had only a cursory interest in what happened to the price of their shares on the stock markets. Their definition of stock trading and legitimate business was unique to them. Could be found in no dictionary unless it was one they wrote themselves. They had not bought their stocks and bonds, notes and bills in the ordinary manner through brokerage houses or from banks. They had accumulated them from the mail sacks of the United States Postal Service, from private homes, from the vaults of such major banks and brokerage houses as Manufacturers Hanover Trust Company, Bankers Trust Company, Security Pacific Bank, Continental Illinois Trust Company, Blair & Company, Shearson, Hamill, Merrill Lynch, Pierce, Finner & Smith, and a lot of others, and from the private engravings and printing presses of their friends, allies, and employees. They had never paid the going market price for a single share in their portfolio. If they had paid anything at all, it had never been more than a fraction of the market value. What DiLorenzo and Risso were, in fact, were major figures in the world of organized crime, men respected and honored by those at the very top and held in awe and no little fear by those below. They owed their positions not so much to the use of traditional muscle and force, though they weren't afraid to use violence when they thought it necessary. Indeed, Rizzo thought it necessary more often than not, but more to the fact that they were prime earners. They had the instinct to smell where the main chances lay and seize them. They knew how to take a dollar and turn it into 10 or more, and so enrich themselves and their organization. They had their hands in everything. I warn you. They were the men who controlled the distribution of stolen and counterfeit American securities throughout the world. And that was what had brought them to Munich that spring night. DiLorenzo may have looked like everybody's kindly uncle. Indeed, he was known as Uncle Marty throughout the syndicate, but there was very little softness beneath that surface. He had climbed from the poverty of his native Cerignola in Foggia province and the slums of New York's Lower East Side, had survived and even thrived during the internecine wars of the 30s, 40s, and 50s to emerge as a capo in the crime family once ruled by Charles Lucky Luciano and Vito Genovese. If he had not driven for the very top, it was because he knew the perils of the throne. He was satisfied to be a man close to the top. A friend to all, making money for all, and so cherished by all. 20 years his junior, Vincent Rizzo was smart, shrewd, and ruthless. His tensely coiled body seemed put together with a steel wire. His pockmarked face looked like the inside of an open can of nails. His cold brown eyes were so terrifying that few could stare into them for more than a minute. Before cowering and shrinking away, his world was filled with people who had learned to their sorrow that he was a very dangerous person. He was DiLorenzo's man. The word was that he feared no one, was in awe of no one but his patron. That May night in Munich, waiting for sleep, both DiLorenzo and Rizzo felt safe and secure, convinced that all that lay ahead was more success, greater riches. Their business had been booming. They were certain there was nothing that could disrupt it. They did not know that every word they spoke that spring night was being picked up by a microphone planted in the lamp between their beds, was being transmitted to a tape recorder, and into the ears of two New York City detectives and several Munich police officers hovering in a room down the hall. They did not have any premonition that a net was beginning to close around them and around scores of others, some until then considered reputable businessmen, men beyond reproach. They had no idea that the strands of that net were stretching across the world from New York to Los Angeles to Tokyo to Panama to Buenos Aires to London to Munich to Vienna to Rome. They had no way of knowing that the first strands had been woven 17 months before by some Playboy bunnies. Christmas Eve, New York, 1970. Now, I'd like to continue this. I think it'll make the Pope's visit a lot more interesting than it would have been. It may be a side to the story that no one else will tell you. I'm on one of my furious crusades. I don't care. If people keep statues of the Pope in their living room, and kiss it from top to bottom, or vice versa. It doesn't matter to me. They can stand on their head and spit nickels toward Rome. It doesn't matter to me. What matters is fairness. Why is it the news media sees nothing incongruous and millions of tax dollars being spent to cater to the Pope's needs? I mean, they had every right to say separation of church and state in this country and the benefits that accrue to the Catholic Church as a result of that, including the fact that the coffers of Rome are filled with millions of dollars because the largesse of the U.S. Congress is such that they have allowed tax deduction on monies donated to the Catholic Church. So, the price tag of the Pope coming is a contribution by the Vatican to the bill that's being footed by U.S. tax dollars to take care of him while he's here. He wants to come. You say, is that what you want? No, no, really, it isn't. I don't care if the Protestants would get fair and equal treatment. But why do we always see pictures of the mansion and the cars that Protestant preachers, particularly TV preachers, drive and live in? Now, I run around in a Rolls Royce limousine, one of five known to exist, bought by Dr. Gene Scott Incorporated with art money. That's my right. I painted the pictures. We pay tax on those dollars. But nobody would even stop to find out the truth. The assumption is, I heard some lame-brained newsman said, how do you justify a preacher running around in Rolls Royce? Well, he can paint better than a newsman. Simple. Probably write better. George Putnam, the exception. And there are a few others that feel as I do about these Johnny-come-latelys. They don't even know how to grind coffee. I just don't think it's fair. You say, well, you know, we got to watch these TV evangelists. Jim Baker took $1 million of the faithful. Well, hell, $15 million, local and national, will be spent to protect the Pope while he's here. And nobody asked my permission for my tax dollars to be so used. Including some awful poor people. Well, but there's been some crookedness in the TV evangelist family. Well, yeah, I've been telling you that for 11 years. That's why I ain't a member of that family. But that leads me to the story I'm reading. The Vatican Connection. By Richard Hammer. The astonishing account of a $1 billion counterfeit stock deal between the Mafia and the Church. Christmas Eve, New York, 1970. By the middle of that cold, bleak afternoon, what little remained of the holiday spirit had begun to dissipate, and the angry heat rising from the shoving crowds of frantic shoppers filling the stores and sidewalks, among the staggering drunks spilling out of office buildings after a little too much party. Even in the scowls that had replaced the broad smiles of the street corner Santa Clauses, whose ringing bells and loud ho-hos had begun to take on a threatening timbre, demanding that passerbys drop something into the pot. But that afternoon, there were not many detectives in the offices of District Attorney Frank Hogan's Rackets Bureau on Leonard Street in downtown Manhattan. Some of the 60-odd investigators assigned there were on vacation, and many more had somehow managed to break away early. The few who had straggled back after lunch, scratched away at paperwork, one eye fastened on the clock, wishing the hours away until it's time to quit work, go home to the kids, maybe finish trimming the tree and putting out the presents, and have a couple of days to forget about work. In that nearly empty office, about the last thing anybody wanted as dusk settled over the city was to see somebody walk in with a problem he wanted solved right away. So there were inward groans when Assistant District Attorney Gerard Hinckley strode through the door. Just behind him was a man who had the look and the smell of an expensive lawyer. The kind who doesn't show up at the district attorney's office bearing holiday largesse or even season's greeting. The kind who appears only when there's trouble. That he was the bearer of bad tidings was apparent from the look on his face. From the purposeful, tight way he walked. Hinckley and the attorney headed directly for the private office of Inspector Paul Vetrano, the commanding officer of the detectives in the Rackets Bureau, and disappeared inside, closing the door behind them. A few minutes later, the door opened, and Vetrano stepped outside. His eyes moved slowly around the room, searching. Nobody wanted to meet that gaze. Terry, he called out. Montello, come in here. I want to see you now. Detectives John Carey and Lou Montello looked at each other and sighed, rose slowly from their desks and crossed the room to Vetrano's office, followed him inside. We got a little problem, he said, and I want you guys to get on it. He introduced them to a very disturbed and angry lawyer who wanted action, who wanted it immediately. He represented the Playboy Club on East 59th Street in Manhattan. Some tough punks, he said, had been making a lot of trouble and they had to be stopped. Though he had just learned about it, and of course it immediately brought the news to the district attorney's office, the hoodlums had appeared at the club a few months before, had forced their way in, and through threats and violence had been trying to take it over and had come very close to doing just that. They had the club management so terrified that they were able to do just about anything they pleased. Their friends had been named to positions of trust and control. Anytime they walked in, they demanded and got free meals and booze. With no interference from the frightened management, they sold marijuana, cocaine, and pills right out in the open and operated the flourishing loan-sharking business at the bar and from a center table. Anyone who tried to interfere, who even voiced a mild complaint, was bullied, threatened, and beaten. This open and arrogant display had been enough to drive some customers away. Even the bunnies were not immune. They were, in fact, special targets. The hoodlums had been supplying them with drugs and pills, had been forcing narcotics on them, turning some of them into users. And they had been pressuring some of the bunnies into becoming high-priced hookers, part of a stable for which they pimped. This despite a rigid club policy against any bunny even dating a customer. A few of the girls had objected and threatened to carry their complaints to the authorities if they weren't left alone. The result had been beatings so severe that the girls had been unable to work for days afterward and warnings that this was only a sample. The situation had become so serious that unless something was done immediately, the future of the Playboy Club itself could be placed in jeopardy. We're quite a ways from the Vatican, but we'll get there. And what a connection. The Vatican connection. The astonishing account. It was not a new story to Carey or Montello, the detectives, or to anyone in the Rackets Bureau. They'd been hearing numerous tales for years of young toughs loose in the city, shaking down nightclubs, restaurants, and bars, extorting protection money, taking clandestine control, building stables of expensive prostitutes from among the girls who worked or hung out in those places. For some of the young hoodlums, this seemed a good way to make a reputation, to impress the bosses of the city's mafia families and so win themselves entrance into the organized crime syndicate. Though essentially a freelance operation, it was carried out with at least the tacit approval of the syndicate rulers, who naturally enough expected a share of the take. It was lucrative. But it was also more than a little dangerous for those who tried it, especially for those who figured they didn't have to cut the bosses in, who thought if nobody knew they were scoring or how much they were scoring, they could pocket the take. A few who had tried, it ended up in the trunks of abandoned cars. Putting their holiday plans aside, Carey and Montello went up to the Playboy Club to see what they might learn. It wasn't much. Most employees wouldn't talk to them. Those who did merely denied that anything out of the ordinary had been going on. The club, they said, was operating just as it always had. The idea of anyone trying to step in and take over was ridiculous, but the bunnies, nearly all of them, were terrified. Some so frightened they refused even to talk to any cop. Most of those who agreed to be interviewed insisted, like the others who worked the club, that there was no trouble. Nobody had been offering them drugs or pills. Nobody had been trying to force them to use narcotics. And certainly, the idea that anybody had been trying to turn them into prostitutes or call girls was too absurd even to discuss. The bruises that were evident on some, they hadn't come from fists or blackjacks or any weapons. They were the result of easily explained accidents. A fall down a flight of stairs, a stumble on some uneven pavement, something like that. But there were a couple of bunnies who were angry and upset enough so that their fear receded just a little, far enough so they talked in private and off the record. Though they would not name any names and refused to look at mugshots in the police files, they did confirm what the Playboy attorney had said. If the bunnies, out of that very real fear, would not cooperate, then perhaps something could be learned just by hanging around the Playboy Club at night and pretending to be customers. That was the next course Detectives Hinckley and Ventrano decided to follow. Carey and Montello were ordered, and it was an order they accepted without much reluctance, to go up to the club and eat, drink, take in the entertainment, and watch what went on. To give this the air of a party, a couple, or rather a group of unattached men, out for a good time on the town, a couple of other detectives would get a chance at the fun along with them. Joe Coffey was one of them, co-author of this book. In his 4 years on the Rackets Bureau Squad, he had emerged as one of the stars, a detective whose memory for people, events, dates, and linkages was almost photographic. A detective who seemed always to find himself in the right place at the right time. A detective whose hunches seemed to pan out and who had had that innate and essential ability to see through bland surfaces to the hidden core. He had already played major roles in several investigations into organized crime, and had been instrumental in the investigations of Cuban terrorists and violence with the Black Panthers. Coffey could act the part of a playboy regular with ease, could probably pass undetected in that circle, and with his memory he might be able to spot, recognize, and catalog any of the hoodlums who showed up. "Be our guest," the playboy attorney offered. "Everything is on the house. If you can stop this thing and put those guys where they belong, it'll be cheap no matter what it costs us." "I've warned you."
"No, sir."
"Go on up there," Hinckley said. "Pretend you're having a good time. See what's really going on. If anything happens while you're there, make a summary arrest on the spot. But the Playboy Club pay the bill? Never. The district attorney's office will pay. Nobody picks up the tab for the men who work for Frank Hogan. He wouldn't stand for it." Want me to continue?
"Yes, sir."
"That young punks were ripping off the Playboy Club in New York City. District Attorney Frank Hogan assigned some detectives, including Joe Coffey, to play the role of customers to see if they could get to the bottom of it, who knew it would lead to the Vatican? One night soon after Christmas, Detectives Terry, Montello, and Joe Coffey and a couple of other detectives had a little party at the Playboy Club. They ate, they drank, they enjoyed the entertainment and the ambience, and they learned nothing they had known before. When the bill arrived at Leonard Street, it turned out that Hinckley's unbending attitude, his insistence that the rules in Hogan's office were unbreakable, the refusal to let the Playboy Club pick up the tab for these detective plants, cost the district attorney more than $400. There was some grumbling, especially since the office was on a meager budget. Still, the office paid, and despite the continuing offers of the Playboy Club to pick up all the costs, no matter how high, the office continued to pay all during the month-long investigation, though after that initial party, only Carrie and Montello enjoyed the club's food and booze on a regular basis. Although those evenings at the Playboy Club were little more than watchful relaxation for the detectives, they were a welcome break from the office's complex and difficult investigation into racketeering in the city's meat industry. They got to know the bunnies well. Though despite the increasing familiarity, the bunnies did not bend enough to offer any help. It hadn't taken more than a few minutes from their initial appearance for the word to spread that the cops were in the place. Looking into rumors, reports, looking for confirmation and evidence, ready to make an arrest at the first sign of trouble. So whenever the detectives were at the club, the hoods were not. And on those nights when something kept them away, the hoods invariably turned up and the trouble erupted again. It was frustrating. It was a pattern that detectives could see no way of breaking. As long as they were there, everything would be peaceful. The moment they were gone, there's going to be trouble. But there was no way they could be there all the time. The office didn't have enough detectives to handle all the other work. What they needed was a break, perhaps somebody who would not be afraid to open his mouth before a grand jury and at a trial. It was more than a month before the break finally came. Carey and Montello were off on another job. The Tufts put in their appearance and went into their usual act. A group of West Point cadets were having a celebration in the club that night. The hoods decided the cadets deserved their special attention. There were some sarcastic comments about Boy Scouts. They were ignored. The remarks got rougher, more pointed, more personal, until the cadets could no longer ignore them and began to respond. That was what the hoodlums had been waiting for. One of them went after a cadet with his fist, broke a whiskey bottle over the cadet's head, and left him on the floor bleeding and unconscious. This was not, of course, the first time something of the sort had happened. In the past, though, the battered patrons of the club had decided the best course was to tend to their bruises and stay away from the club rather than risk another confrontation with people who were obviously just looking for it. Indeed, that was the cadet's first reaction. But unlike most customers of the Playboy Club, he was vulnerable because of what he was, a cadet at the United States Military Academy and a future officer of the United States Army. A couple of days after the beating, Carey and Montello heard about it, passed the news to Ventrano and Hinckley. Hinckley made a call to the officials at West Point. They called the cadet in, advised him strongly to cooperate with the Manhattan district attorney, ordered him to New York to tell his story and identify his assailant. With obvious reluctance, he obeyed his orders. The man he identified was Donald Vigiano, a small-time punk with a record of minor crimes, a mafia hanger-on, who was out to make an impression that would win him favor with the bosses. On February 8, 1971, a grand jury handed down an indictment on Vigiano for criminal assault. But Vigiano was nowhere to be found. For about 3 weeks, the cops looked for him, but he showed up in none of his usual hangouts. Then, early in March, on a miserable winter day, Vigiano was spotted. It was early in the evening. Someone who recognized him called in to say that he was sitting alone in a car on Mulberry Street in Little Italy. Carey and Mantello went out to get him. The car was still parked at the curb. Vigiani still behind the wheel when they arrived. They pulled open the door. Let me continue. I'm reading the Vatican Connection. The astonishing account of a billion-dollar counterfeit stock deal between the mafia and the church all begins with a Playboy club in New York City. Some young hoods were shaking it down. District Attorney Frank Hogan put some cops in there as plants, particularly Joe Coffey. They beat up a cadet one night. It led to an arrest, an indictment with a grand jury of one Donald Vigiano, who beat up the cadet. They found him on Mulberry Street in Little Italy. Carey and Mantello, two of the detectives, went out to get him. The car was still parked at the curb, Vigiano still behind the wheel when they arrived. They pulled open the door, told him he was under arrest and read him his rights. Joe Coffey, the co-author of this book and one of the detectives assigned to pretend there were customers at the Playboy Club to ferret the shakedown out, looked up from his desk and spotted Carey and Mantello as they brought Vigiano into the office. He and several other detectives had been working late, trying to decide whether it was time to venture out into the miserable night for the trip home or wait it out and pray that the rain would begin to taper off. The quiet of the office was broken by the appearance of Vigiano in custody. Coffey and a couple of others rose and wandered over to watch as he was booked, fingerprinted, and photographed. "About your car, Vigiano," Carey said. "Not my car," Vigiano said. "No? Where'd you get it?" "Bought it from a friend." "Yeah? What's the friend's name?" "Crispino. Philip Crispino. It's his car." Coffey nudged Carey. "What's with the car?" "In the back," Carey said, "we found a blackjack, a bunch of credit cards and airline tickets. You know they're hot. Also a little junk. If the car had been Vigiano's, he would have been in serious trouble. That it belonged to somebody else meant he couldn't be touched because of what had been found in it, and neither could the owner. But the name Crispino touched something in Joe Coffey's memory. A faint notion that he had heard that name before. A quick check of police department files turned up a yellow sheet, but it contained little of importance, only a record of a few minor offenses. Coffey was sure there had to be something more. He made a few phone calls, called a few questions, asked more, and a picture of Crespino began to take shape. He was a tall, hulking man in his early 40s with a perpetual sneer. The kind of guy, Coffey would say a long time later, who when you meet him, you want to punch his lights out on the first sight. He was a mechanic for the New York City Transit Authority, taking care of the buses in the garage on Manhattan's Upper East Side. He also took care of a few other things. He ran a shylocking operation for transit workers out of that garage and had a piece of another in Little Italy, where his swaggering presence was cause for fear and concern among his customers. He seemed to enjoy using his massive fists, sometimes with a club or blackjack in them, on people who were slow in their payments, almost as much as he enjoyed collecting his vigorish. He was, the story went, a low-level soldier in good standing in the Genovese family, knew his place, split his take fairly with those in power above him, and carried out whatever strong-arm errands he was assigned. that Vigiano was using Crispino's car and claiming him as a friend, obviously linked the two, and what had been discovered in the back of that car tied them to things of considerably greater moment than a little extortion and assault at the Playboy Club. It tied them to people on a level above them in the syndicate's hierarchy. This was the lead that might point somewhere, and Coffey wanted to follow it. He went to Inspector Vetrano. "We have to call this guy Crispino and tell him we've got his car," he said. "Why don't we tell him to come down now and pick it up? When he gets here, put a tail on him and see what turns up." Vetrano considered that for only a minute. "Good idea," he said. "Get on it. Pick up a couple of guys and move." The call was made. The detectives in the office split into teams, went down to the street, got the cars, parked them pointing in different directions around the spot on the street where Crispino's car had been parked, so that when he drove off, at least one team would be able to pick him up and follow. And then they waited. Crispino appeared about an hour later, went up to the district attorney's office, signed the release for his car, got the keys, made his way out of the office toward the elevators. The call went out to the detectives. "He's on his way down." Crispino appeared, saw his car, got in, sped out into the rain, the blackness of the night, heading north. A block behind, Coffey and his partner, Anthony Saraniero, kept pace. Crispino had no sense that he was being tailed, made no effort to shake his pursuers, and drove directly through the rain-slick streets to the Columbia Civic League Club on 12th Street, just east of 5th Avenue. He parked, got out, went into the club. Coffey parked directly across the street. He and Saraniero slumped down, watched, and waited. Within a few minutes, Crispino, wearing the now-soaked three-quarter-length black leather coat he favored, emerged from the club. With him was a man in a white raincoat. The beam from a streetlight on the corner caught their faces for that moment until they moved beyond it into the shadows. The moment was long enough for Coffey to recognize Crispino's companion. He was Vincent Joseph Rizzo. Though a known member of the Genovese family, Rizzo was not then considered a man of particular importance or especially high rank. "We knew him," Coffey says, "but we didn't think he was anybody special. He was around a lot. We knew he was a wheeler dealer. We knew he had a good, or rather was, a good earner for the mob. We knew he was into a lot of different things, like shylocking, running guns to South America back in 1967, other stuff, but we didn't think he was very high up." Am I boring you? Watching Rizzo and Crispino as they came out of the Columbia Civic League Club, as they stood talking in the rain, Coffey had a sudden intuition that everybody had underrated Rizzo and that they had stumbled onto something of considerable importance. He and others who were investigating organized crime were very familiar with the Columbia Civic League Club. It was not just a standard mafia hangout. It was one of the few places where members of all five New York families, especially those in the upper echelons, were wont together, talk, drink, make their plans in some measure of safety, away from prying eyes and ears. Strangers were not welcome. Knowing that there was no reason Crispino and Rizzo could not have remained inside, where it was dry and comfortable and secure, where they would be among friends and cohorts, Coffey tried to understand why they had decided to go into the freezing rain to have their talk. What was so important, so confidential, that they couldn't talk about it inside? For 10 or 15 minutes, Rizzo and Crispino stood in the shadows in that drenching rain, talking intently. The conversation ended abruptly. Rizzo gave some orders to Crispino, then watched as Crispino got back into the car and drove off. "The hell with Crispino," Coffey said to Saraniero. "Let's sit on Rizzo and see what he does." Rizzo stood at the curb, watching, as Crispino's taillights grew dimmer and then vanished into the darkness. He started back toward the club, stopped, turned, and strode diagonally across First Avenue to a drugstore, went inside, headed for a telephone booth. That was another anomaly. Why would Rizzo go to the drugstore to make a phone call? Why not to the club? Coffey looked at Saraniero. "Tony," he said, get over there. Go into the next booth and see what you can pick up. What number he calls, what he says, anything. Sarniero stepped into the booth next to Rizzo's just as Rizzo was beginning to dial. He had a clear view of Rizzo's back of the phone and was able to see the numbers as Rizzo's finger spun the dial. When it was checked out later, the number turned out to be that of the L&S coffee shop at 201 Avenue A, only a block away. It turned out, too, that Rizzo owned the coffee shop, owned the entire building as well, and lived there with his wife. Sarniero was able to pick up only a few broken phrases from the conversation, such as, "I'll be over in a little while. No, it doesn't look too bad. Yeah, he was just here." Then Rizzo hung up, left the phone booth, recrossed First Avenue, went back into the Columbia Civic League Club. Coffee and Sarniero remained in their car for another half hour. Rizzo did not reappear. There was nothing more for them to do, so they drove back to the office, checked in, went home for the night. The next morning, Coffee went in to see Inspector Vetrano, made his report and concluded, "I think we ought to get on Rizzo right away." "Why?" Vetrano asked. "I've just got a hunch something big is going down." "What have you got besides a hunch?" "That's all. But I'm sure of it. I'm sure we ought to sit on Rizzo and see what develops." Vetrano shook his head. "It's not enough, Joe. We got too much to do in this office right now, and you know it. We can't spare a single man. I think we'll just stand on the Vigiano indictment and let it go at that and get back to work on the meat thing." Coffee argued. Vetrano would not give. "Forget it," he said. "Let's get on with what we have to do." Joe Coffee did not forget it. He went back to work on the meat racket, as he was ordered, but his hunch that they had underestimated Vincent Rizzo, that Rizzo was into something big, kept eating away at him. Even years later, he was not sure why. He remembered only that an alarm had sounded in his brain, that some basic instinct, that indefinable mark of the good detective, had convinced him that something was wrong, was out of place. Particularly in the scene he'd witnessed that rainy March night, that he had caught the edge of something it would be perilous to ignore. If he couldn't forget it, he was determined that nobody else would either. "I made a pest of myself," he says. "Every couple of weeks I'd go in and see Vetrano and bug him about Rizzo. I was bugging Hogan too, everybody. And everyone kept telling him, 'Not now, the office is too busy, there isn't the manpower to spare to play a hunch.'" Though he could not convince them then, his persistence made it certain that when the time and the manpower was available, the name Rizzo would not be forgotten. It may have been inevitable that the paths of Joe Coffey, detective on the rise, and Vincent Rizzo, organizational criminal on the rise, would one day cross at a crucial moment. And then, the book went on to tell a bit of the life story of Joe Coffey, who is the key to this uncovering of the Vatican connection. His hero worship of Bishop Fulton J. Sheen, which I share, which would make it a great shock to him as he uncovers what he's going to uncover of this Vatican connection. His assignment to Hogan's office until when Coffey, through 1971, talked so vehemently about Vincent Rizzo never giving it up, about his hunch, Hogan, the district attorney, finally paid attention. If the time ever came when it was possible and practical, he'd be of a mind to turn Coffey loose. Vincent Rizzo's turf was the few blocks of deteriorating tenements, bars, and small stores on Avenue A below 14th Street. and a chapter on Vincent Rizzo's past. Not a pretty past. But I want to get to the Vatican connection. You want me to quit? Another Christmas passed. After more than a year, the investigation into the meat racket had finally wound down. There had been some good arrests and indictments, and the racket had been set back, but as the cynics in the district attorney's office knew, as experience had shown only too well, it was a small victory that wouldn't last. Before long, the racket would be operating just as broadly as before, and one day they'd have to go after it again. With the investigation over, Joe Coffey went on vacation the first 2 weeks of December, not to play and rest, but to moonlight as a truck driver to earn enough extra money to pay a few outstanding bills and maybe be able to buy Pat and the three children some Christmas presents. On Monday morning, he returned to work. Inspector Vetrano called him into his office. "Have a good vacation, Joe?" he asked. Coffey shrugged. "Okay. About as good as you could expect, considering. You ready to go back to work?" "Sure." "You still interested in that guy, Vincent Rizzo?" Coffey stared hard at him, leaned forward in anticipation. "What do you think I've been breaking?" "My bleats about for the last 10 months. Of course I'm interested in Rizzo, you know it." "Good, we've been talking about him. It's decided. Now it's time to give it a shot. Go pick yourself a partner and get on him. See where it leads." Coffey wanted somebody who would share his own enthusiasm. He approached Larry Mullins, and Mullins, who had just come into the Rackets Bureau, agreed the moment he sensed Coffey's excitement. And that afternoon, before they could start out, Mullins got a phone call from home. His wife had suffered a miscarriage, been rushed to the hospital. Mullins looked at Coffey, told him what happened. "I want to work on this with you, Joe," he said, "but you understand?" "Sure, Larry," Coffey said. They discussed it further, but Coffey would wait for Mullins, would until then move after Rizzo on his own. So taking off solo, waiting for Mullins, he drove up to the Columbia Civic League Club where he had first had that hunch, parked, and waited for his target to appear. The wait wasn't long. Rizzo came strolling along the street, walked into the club, remained there an hour, emerged, and headed east. Coffey tailed him to the L&S coffee shop, knowing now that Rizzo owned it and the whole building, and waited outside while Rizzo went in and talked to several people in a manner that indicated he was giving orders. When Rizzo left, he started north, went not even a block, and entered Jimmy's Lounge, a sleazy bar at 211 Avenue A between 12th and 13th Streets. Coffey continued his lone surveillance over the next several days. Past New Year's, 1972, sitting on Rizzo 18 hours a day. He began to discern a pattern of behavior, to see Rizzo in a new light. Picking up Rizzo outside his apartment house in the morning, he'd follow him to the Columbia Civic League Club, the first stop on the day's rounds. There was no way Coffey could follow inside. It was tightly sealed against intruders, but he could sit in his car across the street and watch. Make note of the license plates of the Cadillacs and other expensive cars that drove up and parked. Make note of those who entered. His notes read like a listing of the hierarchy of all the New York Mafia families. Into the Columbia Civic League Club those winter days went Joseph N. Gallo, Aniello Della Croce, Vincent the Chin Gigante, Phil Tartaglia, Nicholas Pistacci, the regents of the fallen Joseph Colombo, and more, the men who rule the rackets in New York. From his distant vantage, Coffey watched as they huddled together and noted that Rizzo seemed always somewhere near the center. Though he heard none of the words they said, Coffey understood something very clearly and without doubt. Rizzo was no minor mafia soldier. He was accepted into these rarefied circles as an equal. He was treated with the respect due a man of standing. He was somebody very important indeed. Rizzo never stayed at the club long, only long enough to make his presence felt. When he left, he invariably headed for Jimmy's Lounge. The police had not suspected it was a hangout for the organization, but that function came clearly to Coffey almost immediately. Rizzo was using it as an office. He was in and out several times during the day and long into the night. He met people there and on the street outside. He made and received a steady stream of telephone calls, and those who frequented Jimmy's Lounge were men Coffey recognized, men on the middle and lower levels of the syndicate. There was Vincent Popo Totoro, an important man in the Genovese family, a notorious gambler, loan shark, and dealer in narcotics with an arrest record dating back to 1943, when he was 20. Despite nearly yearly arrests, he spent hardly a day in jail. There were soldiers and hangers-on like Freddie Mayo, Jimmy Himmerly, Tommy LaManna, Pasquale, Patty Marino, Joe Caldano, Rizzo's brother, George, and more. If there had been any doubts before about Coffey's intuition and Rizzo's importance, they were now dispelled. These men, coming and going, hanging out at Jimmy's lounge, were into crimes of all kinds, and they were taking orders from Rizzo. Day after day, long into the night, that freezing January, he sat in his car across the street from Jimmy's lounge, hunched down behind the wheel to make himself inconspicuous and visible, and watched. Saw crimes committed in the open with a nonchalance that no one seemed to care, and no one would intervene to stop them. Hardly a day passed when young Puerto Ricans, blacks, Italians did not appear before Totoro, receive small packages, carry them away. Coffey had been a cop long enough to know exactly what was going on. Totoro was dealing street-level junk, he says. There wasn't any question about it. I could have made an arrest right then and there, but I didn't make a move because we were after something else, something a lot bigger, even if we didn't know what, and I wasn't going to tip our hand. If he could see and chart what was happening in the street and on the sidewalk in front of Jimmy's lounge, what was going on inside remained a mystery. The bar was open from 10 in the morning until 4 the next morning, every day but Sunday, when it closed early. Inside, there were clandestine meetings, conversations, phone calls. I had to get in there, Coffey says. The only way we're ever going to know what was going on was to put an informant in there, and the chances of that at that stage weren't very good, to say the least, or plant a bug or a wiretap on the phones. I wanted to build up enough information so we could go to court and get an order to put the place up. So even though I was working for myself until Mullins got back, I made up my mind that I'd go undercover. Go in and take a look. There was a time when I used to moonlight as a steam fitter to make a little extra money. What I did was put on those old clothes like I was still a steam fitter and start going into the place on a regular basis about 6 o'clock and hang around the bar, drink some beer, and see what I could pick up. Unlike the Columbia Civic League Club, which was out of bounds, Jimmy's Lounge was open to outsiders, though why any outsider should have wandered into it and stayed more than a minute was an enigma. It was an Aegean stable, filthy and repellent. It had not been painted in years or even cleaned since the day it opened. The walls, furnishings, everything was coated with thick layers of dirt, grime, and grease, and roaches and vermin played undisturbed games in the litter. Had anyone bothered to complain, the health department could have closed it on a dozen different grounds, yet it had its customers, and they were not just Rizzo. Totoro and their friends and underlings. Laborers in the neighborhood were wont to drop by after work for a beer or two before going home, and even some of the cops from the local precinct stopped in now and then, some on a regular basis. Thus, Coffey did not appear totally out of place at the bar in his worn, dirty steam fitter's clothes. Still, he was a stranger, and no one exactly welcomed him or tried to strike up a conversation. The other patrons, the regulars, moved away, left a space around him at the bar, pretended he was invisible, and that suited him. The first evening, he strolled in, and every evening thereafter, he made sure he found a vacant spot at the bar opposite the telephone, ordered a beer, spent the next couple of hours sipping, watching, and listening. Though his expression was bland, distant, uninterested, he noticed several things immediately. Rizzo and Totoro were engaged in a hushed conference at one of the tables. The phone had an out-of-order sign on it, but it rang continuously. The barmaids, Lorraine and Tootsie, were usually the ones who answered it. The calls were almost always for Rizzo or Totoro, and though Coffey couldn't hear what the caller said, he heard distinctly Rizzo and Totoro's end of the conversation. They acted as though they had total privacy, as though nobody could possibly be listening in, as though that tall steam fitter at the bar didn't exist. What Coffee heard was enough to add weight to his assurance that his hunch had been right and he was on to something very big. "Yeah," he heard Rizzo say one evening, "well, you tell that bleeping rag picker if he doesn't come up with a dough, he's going to end up with two broken kneecaps." "I don't give a damn about his alibis. You tell him I don't make no jokes. I mean it. You tell him pay up, no more bleeper. He's got busted legs, busted kneecaps, maybe worse." Outside in the street, Coffee had seen narcotics. Now inside, he has learned about extortion and more. His time drinking beer at the bar in Jimmy's Lounge came to an end, though, the night Rizzo picked up the phone and said, "Yeah, I agree. We got to have a meet. When? Tomorrow. Ponte's. I'll be there. You be there." Ponte's restaurant was the antithesis of Jimmy's Lounge, near the piers on Manhattan's Lower West Side. It had a reputation for good and expensive Italian food and a fashionable clientele. Was a gathering place for important people from the worlds of business, finance, politics, society, and the underworld. If Rizzo was going to meet somebody there, Coffee would tail him and find out who. He would not, of course, go inside. He'd wait and observe from the outside. All he would have needed was to see me, the steam fitter, from the bar at Jimmy's, walk in. And that would have blown it right there and then, Coffee says, but I figured I'd pick up something just watching who went in, who came out. Those who went in, Coffee observed from his car in the cold and the dark near the waterfront, were Phil Tartaglia, a major figure in the Joe Bonanno crime family, Jerry DiLorenzo, and several others. About 2 hours after all had entered, Rizzo came out. With him was Jerry DiLorenzo. And we got the two together now. That'll be in the hotel in Munich. They were talking with considerable animation and intensity. And Coffee was struck by the repetition of what was becoming a very familiar pattern. The discussion was one between equals, or if one was more equal than the other, it was Rizzo. DiLorenzo was listening with absolute concentration, his attitude one of respect shown only to a man of importance. Watching them drive off, Coffee knew that whatever was happening was spreading and growing rapidly, that it had become far too big for a single detective operating alone, or even for two men. Mullins was ready to join him now. The next morning, he was back in the office, closeted with Vetrano and then with Hogan. They listened. Now, we're going to end up in the Vatican. You want me to continue?